From NPR News. Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barber shop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. You know, we couldn't leave them home, so we brought them all to Philly with us. Joining us for a shape up from Philadelphia are author Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney and editor Arsalan Iftikhar, Republican strategist Ron Christie, and Philadelphia's own Mark Lamont Hill, associate professor of education and African American studies at Columbia University. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Listen, before we go much further, I got to shout out WCPN 90.3 in Cleveland. Good to be home. Welcome to the future. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends, and I see a few enemies. Welcome to the shop. How are we doing?
Hey. What's happening?
Welcome to my city.
Philadelphia.
Yeah. You run the city, man, so you're the man. All right.
Well,
let's get things started. Now, picking up on your earlier conversation, Michelle, about diversity in the newsroom, some members of the media are still getting heat for how they talk about the president. Now, this week, MSNBC's political analyst Pat Buchanan referred to the president as your boy on Al Sharpton's news show. Woo!
Right. In fact, for people who missed it,
You got some tape.
We'll just play it for you so you can understand what we're talking about. Here it is.
Drop it.
And let me tell you, your boy, Barack Obama, caved in on it in 2010, and he'll cave in on it again.
My what? My president, Barack Obama? What did you say?
He's your boy in the ring.
No, he's nobody's boy. He's your president, and he's our president, and that's what y'all are going to get through your head.
Wow. You got to check himself before he wreck himself, right? You know what? In related news, Colorado Republican Congressman Doug Lamborn this week, he called President Obama's debt ceiling policy a tar baby. And lots of folks, but not me, took offense to that, Michelle.
Well, you know, so I'm going to ask people what they think about this. Do you think that this is intentional? Obviously, many people interpret this as disrespect, but I'm wondering if other people, you think it's ignorance, they don't really understand what they're saying and the impact that it is going to have on certain people who are hearing it. Mark, this is your town, so we'll go to you first.
I think that's part of it. I mean, I doubt that the congressman decided to use the word tar baby in full public view, knowing he was going to get pilloried by the media. He used the word tar baby in a way that he didn't understand. But one of the privileges of whiteness and one of the privileges of white supremacy is that you don't have to know that certain terms offend people. No, I'm not letting him off the hook. I'm saying he should be on the hook because he made a mistake. No. He should be aware of what's going on.
I totally disagree with that. Listen, man, the trope of the tar baby, I mean, that goes back to Joe Harris's book, Uncle Remus, right? And yeah. And these are stories he collected from the black oral tradition. And the tar baby is just a sticky situation. It's just a metaphor for a sticky
situation.
That's
my point. That's
so
my
you
point.
Think he should have?
I'm saying he didn't understand
that
as a racist term.
Well, and certainly
he should have.
And certainly he should have. But I'm okay with it. I mean, I think the metaphor was apt. I'm sorry.
Nah, see, that's where it gets.
Wait. Could he have chosen a different metaphor? Probably.
Yeah.
Probably. RC, you want to jump in here, man?
I do, and I think I agree with both of you gentlemen. Actually, I think it's ignorance. He should have known the historical context of what that type of phrase means. But on the other hand, I don't think the congressman meant anything racial by it, but having the first African-American president in the White House, you're going to leave yourself open to certain criticism, to certain interpretations. If you say things like that, I thought it was a stupid thing to say. He put it out there in the record, and I think we should be talking about it.
What about Patrick Buchanan, though?
Look, I've known Pat Buchanan for probably like the last 15 years, and
I don't think...
Hey, we all have our different friends. That's what diversity is about in this country. I don't think that he meant anything racist by it. But I thought that was one of the more stupid things I've ever heard him say.
Well, I don't think so. That didn't bother me at all.
That didn't bother Mark.
That's your boy, Pat Buchanan, man.
Wait, hold on. I have to hear this. Mark, that did not bother you.
No. I mean, when I see Al Sharpton, I'd be like, what's up with your boy, Barack Obama? Because he's tripping right now.
But there's a difference between you and Patrick Buchanan,
is there not?
I've never confused the two of you.
That's for sure. But I don't think boy is a term that people use boy in all sorts of ways.
Well, just to clarify for people who aren't, we haven't forgotten about you. to just to clarify for people who may not understand why it is that many people find it offensive to call a black man a boy. Jimmy, do you want to break it down?
Well, I mean, you don't call a black man a boy. You don't call any adult male over the age of six a boy. It's derogatory.
It goes back to slavery.
Unless that's your friend, unless you have an intimacy with that person.
Exactly. Like,
that was his point. That was what Buchanan was saying.
Right.
But he doesn't have. Well, if there is an intimacy, I'm unacquainted with it.
But see, Pat Buchanan meant it in a different way. And
you sound like Michael from Good Boys, a white racist word. But, I mean, I get it, but I don't think that's what he was going for right now.
Okay, well, let's hear from R. Salon. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's we have to look at things holistically. You know, a few months ago we had the Fox Business News guy saying, you know, Barack's drinking 40s in the White House and, you know, the terrorist fist. I mean, this is part of an entire meta-narrative that we're seeing where, you know, these are code words that are being said. And also, I mean, Jimmy, for the last 4 years, I mean, being a Barack supporter since our days in Chicago, you've been calling him
my boy for years.
That's your
boy. But see, my whole thing is that they're bigger fish to fry.
What I'm saying is that, you know, had we another white American as president, I don't think that we'd be seeing these. I don't think anybody would be talking about, you know, drinking 40s in the White House.
Well, I mean,
that's racist.
But wait a second. When W was in the White House, I called him the frat boy in chief. You know, I mean, I didn't have any problem with
it. But there's nothing racialist about that.
But here's the difference, guys.
Go ahead.
Look, I would never, and I worked for President Bush. I'm friends with President Bush. I would never.
My apologies again.
Yeah, that don't sound diverse.
Right. Hey, fellas, easy. But I would never have referred to him as my boy, the president, because I think it's disrespectful to say your guy or your boy Bush.
Right.
In the same sense that I think it was a mistake that Buchanan said your boy, making the remarks towards Barack Obama. He's the president of the United States, and I think there's a certain level of respect and dignity if you're in public life, like many of us are, that you don't say things about that, regardless of the color of the skin of the president.
Can I just say one thing, though? I am so tired of people telling us that they're just emulating, you know, what hip-hop heads say. Mm. Like, you know, this is the excuse. It's like, well, I'm just saying what you all say. In what other area of life are these particular individuals taking direction from hip-hop heads?
Right.
Stock tips? Yeah. I mean, investment advice?
Exactly.
Excuse me,
right.
Real estate? I mean, they're not, you know, so tell me why it is that in this unique area people feel that they can appropriate language. And because they're down with it.
See, that's why I said
well,
stupid.
Yeah, I think MTV did that. I think MTV made it cool to just appropriate hip-hop. But we'll get to that later.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to our weekly Barbershop segment from Philly. We're joined by author Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar, African-American studies professor Mark Lamont Hill, and Republican strategist Ron Christie. Back to you, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Now, a lot of people have bad stuff to say about the government in general and the president specifically. Obama, your boy. No, I mean,
because of the economy.
But even with it, but you know, we had some numbers dropped today. You smell that?
Right.
Fresh numbers.
Right. We talked about this a little earlier in the program as we talked about the economy added 117,000 jobs in July. That was much better than many analysts, whoever these analysts are, were expecting, but certainly much better than the numbers in June, where it was a very pitiful 18,000 new jobs, and the jobless rate has dropped slightly from 9.2% to 9.1%. I'll just play a short clip of the president who talked about this morning.
Drop it.
What I want the American people and our partners around the world to know is this. We are going to get through this. Things will get better, and we're going to get there together.
Thank you, Michelle. Thank you. RC, check in on that.
Well, I think things are going to get better, but I think they're going to get worse before they get better. I think you need to create somewhere in the ballpark of 200,000 jobs a month to bring down the unemployment rate.
I'll take $200,000, by the way.
Yeah, I'll take that, too.
I want that, too.
I'll take 50.
I think regulations imposed by this administration, the health care bill imposed by this administration, is going to drive taxes up. I think it's crippling the economy, and I think that we need to allow the small businesses in this country to really unleash and really create jobs. But this administration has done, in my opinion, a disservice to creating jobs, and it's been a barrier and an obstacle rather than being a inhibitor of trying to create jobs.
Can I just ask you a question about that? Because, you know, I know many Republicans, particularly conservatives, continue to focus on health care and the health care mandate and so forth. But why wouldn't one make an argument that creating another market for healthcare, which allows small businesses to offer this to their employees when they can not now, is actually a job creator? Why wouldn't it be, given that people can not invest as much of their income in healthcare as they are now doing, and it takes some of the drag off?
Because you see providers like Harvard Pilgrim up in Massachusetts saying the restrictions that were put on by Obamacare make it cost prohibitive for them to stay in business, so they're going to get out of business. You see insurers and providers saying that it's more cost-effective for us to get out of this. That's why it's a job killer, to say nothing about the 0.9% Medicare tax that's going to be imposed next year. More taxes, more regulations, and people who are looking at this and saying, is this smart? Should I be in this? No, they're getting out of the system.
A-Train.
Well, what's interesting to me is, you know, we always hear this code word job creators, which means rich-ass people, you know, people making $250,000 and above. You know, this is... You know, during the whole debt ceiling debate, you know, we need to generate revenue. And, you know, the vast majority of Americans in public polling showed that they supported, you know, tax increases for people making over $250,000 a year. Now, the Republicans, what they've done is they use the code word job creators to, you know, somehow push back against that. And I understand that, you know, these people might be job creators, but these are also people, you know, in the top 0.1% of income brackets in America.
And you've been terribly rich, not that term you used earlier.
Yeah, he's giving us that Dave Chappelle punditry.
You meant terribly rich.
I meant terribly rich. Terribly rich.
Pinkies up.
No, Mark? I agree. I mean, I think that it becomes, there's always this sort of sky is falling clamor that comes whenever people talk about revenue increases, tax increases and such. People say, oh my God, it's going to kill jobs, it's going to inhibit growth. The fact of the matter is what the president should have done is actually force revenue increases, force tax increases,
right,
so that the uber rich, the ultra rich, would be able to pay their fair share. And I don't think that it would have inhibited job growth. In fact, the one thing we saw in this debt ceiling debate was the absence of a conversation about job growth. The president caved on everything, and there was not one piece of that bill that actually created the very jobs that we're talking about right now. And that, to me, is the issue.
Okay, well, moving on, before we let you all go, President Obama had a big birthday this week. It was his 50th birthday, and I know you all convey your very best wishes for all of you. But MTV celebrated its 30th anniversary this week. So where were you when it launched, Jimmy? I know this was a pivotal moment for you.
Actually, it wasn't, because my mom couldn't afford cable. So I was at home wishing I had cable. But what I did see is how it changed the kids around me. And it kind of gave them an eye into this catalog of cool that MTV had become. And then it kind of drove the consumer culture. What I think, though, about MTV, it was kind of the end of hip-hop as we know it. Because Yo MTV Raps...
What?
Yeah, okay.
This is where your Cleveland is coming out.
You have nothing to say.
Hear me out. Bone Thugs.
Hear me out.
Security. Security. I need to hold them apart.
Hear me out. Hear me out.
Please, I got to hear
you. Hear me out. Because both of us teach about hip-hop a bit. And my feeling about MTV is that it gave the hipsters a chance to look into this culture in which they had no stakes and draw from it to absorb, appropriate, and eventually kind of claim this culture that wasn't theirs without having to engage the people of this culture. Hold on one moment. And for me, this went not to business. Go ahead.
Well, see, I mean, that's ironic because, and I'm not even kind of Cleveland right now, the reason you had access to a New York piece of art, a New York hip-hop aesthetic, is because of MTV. These things broadcast a New York Bronx art creation to you.
We don't agree on that.
No,
so
that's how you got hip-hop. That's how you got hip-hop, Jimmy. But the bigger point here is that hip-hop didn't get appropriated because of MTV. There's a whole lot of reasons why hip-hop got appropriated, but it ain't because of MTV. What MTV did was create a market, created a space to see all sorts of hip-hop exist. Not just one kind, but Tribe Called Quest.
Well, and let's not forget that MTV did not actually even air black artists for many years until
time.
You know,
right.
Billie Jean, you know, in what, 83 or 84. But what's interesting to me, you know, the first video, very symbolically, on August 1st, 1981, was Video Killed the Radio song. And so, you know, by the Buggles. And so, you know, for me, it was that transit. I mean, granted, I was 4 years old, but I mean, I watched it. You know, but it was that transition from sort of an auditory experience to now more of a visual video experience.
Right.
I think that's exactly it. I mean, it definitely changed my life. I remember it opened up a whole new world. I mean, you saw a whole
different... You watch
different-
TV?
Yes. I saw a whole different culture, a whole different
Ron
aspect.
Ron has a whole other side.
That's
know.
Right.
He hang with George Bush and Pat Buchanan. I don't know.
Exactly.
He's obviously a Beavis and Butthead guy.
Oh, come on.
But go ahead,
see,
Ron,
I had
you
to
were
throw
saying.
Pat Buchanan and George Bush.
But for have you guys, you know, what is with the left with George Bush just for once? I think MTV opened the minds and opened really the eyes of a lot of people who'd never seen an entire hip-hop culture. They'd never seen an East Coast culture. And they thought, there's a whole different world out there. That's how I felt as a little kid.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's pretty cool.
But what do you mean when you say appropriation? I always wonder what that means. I mean, doesn't art belong to everybody? Doesn't culture belong to everybody? I mean, we all eat spaghetti and salsa and, you know, whatever. You know what I mean? Why aren't we allowed to have access to the culture, even if we didn't originate it? I mean, we like... What do you mean by appropriation?
I think there is having access, and I think there's appropriating. I think taking it for yourself, taking it as your own, and not giving anything back to the stakeholders. You know, that's my opinion.
Isn't that record sales? Isn't that what that is? Giving something back? What is it?
Because they're the only ones buying it.
Right.
Well, the only reason people sell about records
because you're helping me make my point. Because I believe that the MTV culture diluted the culture, diluted hip-hop culture, and it changed the message, and it's not what it was.
There's all sorts of hip-hop going on around. Outside of what's on MTV, you can still find artists like Kweli, like Jean Grey. Like, I mean, going down, you can go even deeper on the underground and find those folks.
But is really MTV even about music anymore?
No.
I mean, because really,
the videos that really
have an impact, how do people access them? They go to their sites. I mean, if you think about the videos that have made news, like, you know, Telephone, Lady Gaga, so Telephone or Kanye's, Peters or something like that. But I have to wonder, though, if MTV were more present in music, would there be more politics in conversely? I'm thinking about, like, MIA, for example, the videos, which are the most provocative ones, but don't get a lot of airplay, and I'm sort of wondering
about
that.
Well, you know what's interesting about that phenomenon, Michelle, is that, you know, like in 1986, you know, when Run DMC and Aerosmith did Walk This Way together, at the time, that was groundbreaking stuff. You know, here you had a white rock band and a black hip hop band collaborating for the first time, and it sort of brought these two cultures together. And for everybody who was watching TV at the time, it was really a groundbreaking era.
All time favorite video, all time.
Girls on Film, Duran Duran.
Oh right, all time.
Thriller, Michael Jackson.
I'm going with Thriller.
Thriller.
Make it three.
Thriller.
Absolutely.
Right. Okay. It's a consensus. Jimmy, as usual, the outlier. Jimmy Israel is a freelance journalist and author of the book The Denzel Principle. Ron Christie is a Republican strategist and former aide to President George W. Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney. And Arsalan Iftikhar is a civil rights attorney, founder of TheMuslimGuy.com and managing editor of The Crescent Post. Mark Lamont Hill is an associate professor of education and African American studies at Columbia University and host of the TV show Our World with Black Enterprise. Thank you all for joining us from our broadcast from the National Association of Black Journalists Conference in Philadelphia.
Peace.
Peace.
See you later.
Yep, yep.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Allison Keyes will be sitting in the host chair next week. She will talk more with you on Monday.